Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
Kelsey Davenport, you're Director of Non-Proliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. To start with, just give me a potted history of Iran's nuclear ambitions, as in, what were their stated goals and were their actions consistent with those goals?
So Iran's nuclear intentions have shifted over time. And in the 1950s, when countries began to be interested in civil nuclear power and the applications of nuclear for things like medical work, the Shah of Iran actually approached the United States, and the United States provided Iran with its first research reactor. Iran at that point wanted the capabilities to produce enriched uranium or separate plutonium. These technologies can be used for nuclear fuel, but also to provide the fissile material for nuclear weapons. Now, after the Shah was deposed, the first supreme leader, Khomeini, was not interested in civil nuclear power. But his thinking on nuclear began to shift during the Iran-Iraq War, and Iraq's ability to target Iranian cities with its ballistic missiles, its decision to use chemical weapons against Iran with very little international condemnation, that's when we really see the origins of the organized nuclear weapons program that Iran began to pursue in violation of its nuclear non-proliferation treaty commitments. And that organized program continued largely to 2003. And at that point, it seems that Iran made the decision to abandon the organized nuclear weapons effort, which had been discovered. Iran was beginning to pay a price for having deceived the international community. And at that point, it appeared to view its nuclear program more as leverage. So it was interested in diplomacy through that period, but preserving its option to weaponize if the security situation shifted.
So Iran was expanding its civil nuclear capabilities, but also clearly investing in technologies that meant it could move quickly towards building a bomb. We know they have this stockpile of 400-odd kilograms of 60% enriched uranium. Now, anything over 20% uranium-235 is known as highly enriched uranium, and then weapons-grade uranium is enriched to about 90%. But is it possible to make nuclear bombs of some kind of design with the 60% enriched material we know they already have?
It is possible to use 60% enriched uranium to build a bomb, but there are a few caveats I would throw out. First, the material that Iran has enriched to 60% is almost exclusively in gas form. Now, that does pose more of a proliferation risk because it's the gas that's injected into centrifuges that can be enriched to weapons-grade levels. So if Iran wanted to weaponize this 60%, it would need to convert it into a metallic form, shape it, fit it with the explosives package. But because the uranium is only enriched to 60%, it would require much more of the material itself. So the bomb would be bigger, it would be much more unwieldy, and the reliability of that weapon would not be the same as if you were using the material enriched to 90%.
And before those attacks last June, what were weapons inspectors and intelligence services thinking about whether Iran had made that decision to go for a bomb?
Well, when we assess proliferation risk, you have to look at both the technical elements. You know, does a country have the means to produce that fissile material, the explosives package, deliver it, and the political intention to do so? Now, from a technical perspective, it looked very much like Iran had made a decision to weaponize. They were on the threshold of nuclear weapons. They were very close. But nothing in the intelligence assessments, nothing in the IAEA reports suggests that that political decision had been made, that there was an organized effort to develop nuclear weapons. So that tells us that those technical advances could have been designed to try to provide some deterrent value by going all the way up to the threshold of nuclear weapons and threatening to cross that threshold. It's likely that Iran was trying to deter attack. Ultimately, that proved not to be successful. But this was also likely about leverage, given that there was no decision to weaponize.
Kelsey, when the US and Israel attacked Iran's nuclear facilities last June, Trump said they had obliterated that country's nuclear program. What do we know actually about how much damage was caused during those strikes last year?
It is impossible to obliterate capability. Now, the U.S. strikes did cause significant damage to key Iranian nuclear facilities. It is likely that the uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz and Fordo were destroyed because centrifuges are very delicate machines. So even the shock waves from significant explosions can damage the centrifuge machines themselves. It's also likely that the U.S. Destroyed the entrances to a key part of a third nuclear complex at Esfahan, where Iran was storing most of this uranium enriched to 60%, and where there is a third enrichment facility, the status of which is unknown. It's likely, though, that some centrifuges survived. I mean, since 2021, the IAEA has made very clear that it cannot account for all of Iran's centrifuge machines. So the idea that the U.S. and Israeli strikes obliterated the program, it really doesn't hold water when you look at these details.
There's been some confusing messaging that's come out since those attacks last year. As we mentioned, back in June, Trump said that Iran's nuclear program had been set back permanently. And yet on Wednesday, he sounded like he was saying that if the US and Israel hadn't attacked Iran this time around, they would have had a nuclear weapon within 2 weeks.
If we didn't hit within 2 weeks, they would have had a nuclear weapon. If we didn't do the B-2 attack a number of months ago, they would have a nuclear weapon. And when crazy people have nuclear weapons, bad things happen.
What do you make of that statement? Is that in line with any reliable assessment of Iran's capability and motivation?
The United States has not presented any evidence or intelligence to suggest that Iran's nuclear program posed an imminent threat or that Iran could weaponize that quickly. And I think it's telling that the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, has come out several times and stated that there was no structured nuclear weapons program. So this idea that a nuclear weapon was inevitable attributes to Iran an intention to weaponize that simply wasn't there, particularly if you consider how the Iranian negotiating team pursued that third round of talks with the United States in Geneva just 2 days before the strikes. Iran actually put a proposal on the table, and this proposal showed some flexibility, showed some willingness to take concrete steps to roll back the nuclear program that Iran had been unwilling to take in the past. So again, if we look at the entirety of the picture, there is no good case to say that Iran posed an imminent threat, that it could build a bomb in just 2 weeks. I mean, frankly, it's absurd.
Coming to these latest attacks that Iran has been enduring for the recent days, is there any assessment of how much damage those have caused to the nuclear program? Have they added an additional load of damage to that program?
It does appear that there have been some strikes near the Natanz complex that might make it more difficult to access that facility. There also have been some strikes around Isfahan, and there have been some strikes on what may be buildings that were occupied by scientists. But if we look at the overarching campaign, the nuclear program, nuclear infrastructure has not been a focus of the U.S. or Israeli bombing campaigns.
We've talked about this stockpile of enriched uranium, particularly that 440 or so kilograms of 60% enriched uranium. How important do you think that material is in this latest conflict? What happens to it? Can it be put under inspectors' control or what have you?
I think at the end of the conflict, determining what to do with that 60% stockpile will be crucial and perhaps could even be negotiated as part of an agreement to end the conflict, as part of a ceasefire. Because I think it will be very challenging politically for the United States to allow that stockpile to remain in Iran. But it's also very challenging to figure out what to do with it. Uranium enriched to 60%, you have to be careful how you transport it. I mean, the canisters themselves are quite small. Think about something about the size of a scuba tank. And they're relatively mobile. But if you have a lot of 60% material together, hitting that with an explosive could actually ignite a fission reaction. So if the U.S. is concerned about the 60% material in Iran now, it can't bomb it. I mean, that's quite risky. Any type of recovery option would be, I would envision a massive military presence on the ground to secure the site, excavate it. Any boots on the ground is going to put American lives in danger. It's going to cost more. It's going to risk, again, the U.S. getting bogged down. So there will be significant political opposition.
Coming up, could the war push Iran to weaponize?